The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, we look at the militarization of the global drug war. Ambika Sakkunanathan is a human rights lawyer and human rights activist from Sri Lanka.
I will also try to link what's happening in the global north to the militarization in the global south. Globally, increasingly, we are seeing that states are linking the war on terror with the war on drugs to an extent that both are now merging seamlessly into one, with militarization being the common thread linking both. For instance, in Sri Lanka, you see the seamless merger of the war on terror and the war on drugs. According to government rhetoric, the military, which they say successfully saved the country from the threat of terrorism, will also save the country from the threat of drugs. The normalization and entrenchment of militarization is aided by the existence of permanent states of exception, or what we call, you know, permanent states of emergency, that have been created by declaring states of emergency and or enacting anti-terrorism laws that impinge on human rights. A militarized permanent state of emergency enables the state to easily construct hegemonic narratives in which certain social groups, usually ethno-religious communities, minorities, and drug users, are labeled anti-national and threats to national security. The militarization of policing plays a critical role in this, and it takes place in two ways. States either use the military for policing, and or they militarize the police, who are trained in military tactics and thinking and are given military equipment. In Sri Lanka, the militarization of policing is also done through the president creating a permanent de facto state of emergency by calling out the armed forces to perform policing functions by issuing a gazette every month instead of legally declaring a state of emergency, which would require a parliamentary approval. Militarization of policing often takes place in conjunction with the deliberate construction of a dominant security narrative that posits the military or militarized police as saviors and the only barrier between chaos and order. The police then deal with issues such as border control, counterterrorism, gang violence, drugs with what's called a war mentality. The drug menace and the portrayal of the drug problem as a national security issue has long been used by governments to increase the involvement of the military in drug control. In Sri Lanka, for instance, they're involved in treatment and even drug use prevention activities. Similarly, countering terrorism is a justification commonly used by states for militarizing policing, which is then integrated into everyday police functions. In South and Southeast Asia, the militarization of the war on drugs has had devastating human rights impact. The UN Human Rights Committee has expressed concern, for instance, about the high rate of extrajudicial killings by police, military, and the Rapid Action Battalion members in the war on drugs in Bangladesh. And Amnesty International has said that it's seen at least one death a day due to the war on drugs. In Sri Lanka, as I said, we have the military taking on drug treatment, drug control, and drug use prevention activities as well. A quick word on what's been taking place in Sri Lanka during the last 3 months, which is called the Yuktia operation, which is an anti-drug operation. As at 17th March, that is 3 months since it began, 72,850 persons have been arrested. 2,322 persons have been sent to compulsory drug treatment, and prisons are overcrowded by 205%. Yet, the amount of drugs seized, as you will see, is rather paltry. In 3 months and so many arrests, only 29.4 kilograms of heroin and only 37.7 kilograms of methamphetamine. Like in other countries, many violations have been reported during the operation in which poor communities are the main target, demonstrating that the war on drugs is a war on the poor. persons who use drugs and persons from marginalized socioeconomic groups who sell drugs, or, you know, who sell drugs to buy drugs for their use are the ones who are being targeted. Hence, it's a criminalization of poverty. At the same time, there has been less than a handful of arrests or prosecution of persons engaging in large-scale drug trafficking, raising questions about the protection these people enjoy and their proximity to political power. My final point is on countries in which the police force has been heavily militarized in the global north, such as the US, the United Kingdom, and Australia, which are exporting militarizing police to the global south. They do this through aid, by training police, and by donating military equipment, despite the fact that these initiatives enable human rights violations. For example, a 2021 audit by the US Office of the Inspector General found that many sensitive investigation units and vetted units set up by the DEA in Vietnam were operating outside of formal structures and without adequate oversight. The US aids militarization of policing by providing training to police of other countries at military bases, but in the State Department's yearly foreign military training report, only the city where the training takes place is mentioned, not the fact that it took place at a military base. Militarization is also enabled through training police and military together. For example, the Colombian police, where they received joint operation training from the US alongside members of the Colombian Army and Navy. Police in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Nigeria similarly gained counterterrorism training alongside members of the country's armed forces. In 2020 to 2021, 60% of the police training provided by the US was done by the Asia Pacific Institute for Security Studies, whose faculty is mostly military. Just a few quick recommendations. One is, this is general to member states as well as to the UN. One is that the role of OHCHR as the lead entity in the UN system must be respected and strengthened. Of particular importance is OHCHR's duty to conduct human rights due diligence of UN agency programs to ensure that they adhere to international human rights standards and the UN common position on drugs. The critical role of the UN resident coordinator in the country in the implementation of the UN common position on drug must be recognized, because it can be a catalyst for and create a common platform for multi-agency coordinated action. And of course, during the UPR process, member states can issue recommendations related to specific countries that support civil society recommendations related to drug control and treatment issues. Thank you.
That was Ambika Sakunanathan, a human rights lawyer and human rights activist from Sri Lanka, speaking at a side event entitled The War on Drugs, Militarization and States of Emergency, Measures to Address These Critical Human Rights Challenges, which was held March 21st at the 67th session of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, and on this edition of Century, we're looking at the militarization of the global drug war. John Walsh is the Director for Drug Policy and the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America.
The word war is often deployed as a metaphor to indicate urgency and society-wide mobilization for a cause. Think the war on poverty in the United States, for instance. But the war on drugs has never been just a metaphor. And Latin America has been one of the primary theaters in which this very real war has been waged. And like most wars, the primary casualties are civilians. So it's crucial that the Office of the High Commissioner is shining a light on the problem of militarized drug control and human rights violations. From our point of view at WOLA, the history is very clear. Drug prohibition and militarized enforcement are an especially toxic mix from that perspective of human rights. So there's at least five dimensions that shape the dynamics of militarized drug control in Latin America in particular, to recognize before we talk about the perverse dynamics that prohibition itself creates. First, internal security roles and missions for militaries are not a new development in Latin America. The Cold War in particular saw the rise of the national security state, with security forces focused on repressing the enemy within, and giving rise to massive human rights violations. There's a long history of uncertain civilian control over the military, in part as a legacy of the Cold War, but also predating that. Even where the armed forces do not intervene to depose civilian leaders and take power, accountability to civilian authorities, including the administration of justice, is incomplete at best. The armed forces' own self-identification as guardians of national sovereignty tends to resonate with the public, and civilian political leaders can be tempted to benefit from that popularity by involving the military in public security, including in drug control, especially when citizens are fearful and looking to the government for solutions. If drug enforcement comes to be seen as a political priority and even a political imperative, the scrutiny and accountability for human rights abuses becomes even more difficult to achieve. It's also important to recognize, as already been mentioned, military roles in drug control are often promoted and funded by foreign governments. In Latin America, this has largely been a question of US military aid under the banner of the war on drugs. With the end of the Cold War, the drug threat became at least a partial replacement for anti-communism as a rationale for internal security missions in cooperation with US Southern Command and focused on the Andean region, most notably Plan Colombia. As has also been mentioned, after 9/11, the drug war merged with the war on terror. It's also important to recognize that the aims and objectives of foreign governments and local militaries may not necessarily align. For example, the US and other governments in significant consumer markets typically fund enforcement with the aim of curbing supply. That has not been achieved, to say the least, over these many decades. Local militaries may be happy to receive foreign aid for many purposes, but may not share these goals. Preventing drugs from reaching other countries may, and I would argue should, take a back seat to local needs, immediate local needs. And of course, there are elements of security forces, as well as politicians and local elites, who may themselves become engaged in the illegal drug trade, which is one of the particularly dangerous aspects of putting the military on the front lines of combating an illicit market. So, stepping to the dynamics created by prohibition itself, our collective attempt at banning drug use and criminalizing it makes, as we know, drug use more hazardous while generating at the same time vast revenues that fuel organized crime and corruption worldwide. So while governments tend to describe enforcement as combating drug trafficking, the reality is that our underlying choice of a policy of prohibition has led to burgeoning illegal drug markets that continuously generate enormous profits for groups and individuals willing to act outside the law. The fact is that military and militarized enforcement is ill-suited to respond to these lucrative illegal drug markets, and it leads to especially perverse outcomes, for instance, kingpin strategies to remove leaders of groups, leaders who are easily replaced, and tends to prompt splintering into rival groups that promotes more bloodshed and conflict. We've seen this over and over again in country after country. So these consequences of enforcement, in particular militarized enforcement, may not be intended. They may be unintended, but they're entirely predictable at this point. There's vast evidence. The bottom line is that civilians are the people caught in the crossfire. Even more so, the lines blur as elements of security forces tasked with confronting illegal markets and illegal traffickers become complicit in the trade, making for very messy situations on the ground that would be opaque under the best of circumstances, but given the blurred lines and lack of understanding of who's who, the violence becomes almost impossible to unravel. Add to that declarations of internal armed conflict, declarations that call upon international humanitarian law, not human rights law, to be the focus. We've seen how low that bar is as far as preventing civilian casualties. So that's another enormous concern. So to conclude, I would say the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has already issued a number of extremely important recommendations. For instance, reserve drug law enforcement for civilian law enforcement agencies that are properly trained and equipped, resort to military force extraordinarily, temporarily, and when strictly necessary in specific circumstances, ensure that financial and technical assistance provided for drug enforcement operations does not contribute to human rights violations. Of course, these are easier said than done. For example, under U.S. foreign assistance, there's something called the Leahy Law that's meant to provide oversight and accountability for forces that are implicated in human rights abuses. But these laws don't implement themselves. They require political will, and they require constant information and pressure, especially from civil society, familiar with what's actually happening on the ground. I would add one more vast recommendation, and it's also in the Office of the High Commissioner's important report from last year, moving beyond the prohibition framework to legal regulation. It may seem sometimes impossible to imagine, and it may seem that the prohibition regime has put down such deep roots, which is true, bureaucratically, politically, vested interests. At the same time, I think it's very important to remember this is a relatively recent creation. In my lifetime, in fact, the global prohibitionist drug regime has come to be. This was a conscious and deliberate choice of governments more than half a century ago under very different circumstances. I believe it was ill-suited at the time, is particularly ill-suited with the evidence that's accumulated. And I think that as we look to the future, we need to be looking to the post-prohibition scenario and recognize that one of the major harms that the drug war, prohibition, and criminalized militarized enforcement does is not just untold human casualties and the immense suffering unimaginable is the erosion of institutions and even democracies, not just in Latin America, but around the world. So I think the Office of the High Commissioner shining this light on human rights is a clarion call to, I would say, wake up. The evidence that the war on drugs has failed is vast, and the evidence that in the probability that the harms that it causes are going to become worse, not better, is alarming. So thank you very much.
That was John Walsh, Director for Drug Policy and the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America, speaking at a side event entitled The War on Drugs, Militarization and States of Emergency, Measures to Address These Critical Human Rights Challenges, which was held March 21st at the 67th session of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, and on this edition of Century, we're looking at the militarization of the global drug war. Her Excellency Laura Gil is Ambassador of Colombia in Austria and Permanent Representative of Colombia to the United Nations in Vienna.
Thank you so much. Let me express first the gratitude to the Centro de Estudios Sociales, Legales y Sociales for this invitation, and thanks to all delegations and civil society organizations that co-sponsored this event. But most of all, let me send a greeting to Colombian civil society organizations because they were our guiding light during the very, very difficult years we had to endure. So the Truth Commission in Colombia, in its final report, identified drug trafficking as a factor of persistence of the armed conflict. And all the actors in the armed conflict were involved and are involved in drug trafficking. So drug trafficking is a factor that extended the conflict and the degradation of the war and remains one of the major obstacles to one, peace in Colombia, and two, development in Colombia. And I will not tire of saying this. Colombia is tired. I will not tire of saying Colombia is tired because we are tired of external recipes. For six decades, as President Petro said in his intervention before the plenary of the CND, Colombia was a poster child of the war against drugs. And this war, which was imposed on us by the United States, was also the direct result of the prohibitionism that to this day prevails in Vienna. So let's not lose sight of that. So in the face of failure, my country opted for change. And the new policy on drugs is revolutionary. And revolution for us means common sense. We are making a revolution because we have returned to our senses. We are no longer willing to offer dead Colombians in sacrifice for someone else's global policy. And we do believe in common and shared responsibility. As a matter of fact, that was a principle that came out of Colombia. We formulated it and proposed it to the world in the 80s. But this common and shared responsibility has turned into a blaming game. I produce because you consume, and I consume because you produce. We are committed to overcoming this finger pointing by becoming the visible face of discontent with a global drugs regime that seems to have lost its moral compass. So domestically, we have moved forward. We have adopted a new national drug policy, a people-centered policy, which was drafted with the people in consultation, in visits with territory. More than 274 organizations of civil society participated, 2,700 social leaders provided their inputs, and we put the right of life above everything else because we believe people's lives matter. So, and our new drug policy has two main pillars. We call one oxygen, we call the other one asphyxia. The first pillar is aiming at ending the dependence of the population on the economies of drugs, as well as avoiding the criminalization of peasants. We are no longer persecuting peasant communities in Colombia. Asphyxiation means that we continue making efforts for the dismantling and reducing the influence and capacity of criminal organizations that profit from drug trafficking. As a matter of fact, the number of seizures in Colombia has dramatically increased since this government took over. By placing the people at the center of this action, we want to uphold the respect for human rights, the protection of the environment, and the promotion of peace and justice. We want to protect vulnerable populations, rural and indigenous communities, and we think we have a historical opportunity right now in addressing cross-cutting issues such as racial and indigenous justice, gender equality, and youth rights. But at the international level, our crusade is against hypocrisy and for pragmatism. So for over 30 years, every major UN political declaration here in Vienna says that the world drug phenomenon must be carried out in full conformity with all human rights and fundamental freedoms. So, I get a lot of questions here from delegations who say, why is there so much resistance to have in full conformity with the drug conventions in CND official documents? And my response is, because of the same reason why you don't want International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and so on. If we were in a place where we all accept in full conformity with the drug conventions and the list of international human rights treaties that bind us as much as the conventions, Colombia will go with that. But we are not in a place where that's acceptable. So we believe the report of the Human Rights Commissioner gives us an opportunity. 30 years ago, I was a grad student at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I remember I was already studying the lack of coordination, the lack of coherence between New York, Geneva, and Vienna. 30 years later, I come here as an ambassador, and I find myself having to dispute arguments like human rights can only be discussed in Geneva. Here in Vienna, we discuss drugs. I'm quoting, I'm not exaggerating. These are direct quotes. So, Colombia is fully committed to one United Nations. Colombia is fully committed to human rights. And Colombia will support the High Commissioner for Human Rights to bring human rights into global drug policy. Now, what do we have here? We hear about flexibility of the conventions, and now we see actually is lack of flexibility, a lot of rigidity. Canada and Uruguay get blasted every single year for having regulated cannabis. So we are going to bring some honesty to this conversation. This is what you get. There's nothing else. I'm frank, I'm direct, and I avoid diplomatic talk because I believe my country has no time to waste. We need a change, we need it right now, we need it right now. And I will work as much as I can to respond the mandate that my president has given me. And the mandate he has given me is to bring some change to Vienna. And I'll tell you something. Today, I'm wearing this. This is a Colombian peasant. And I expect to be the voice of Colombian peasant communities in Vienna. Thank you.
That was Her Excellency Laura Gil, Ambassador of Colombia in Austria and Permanent Representative of Colombia to the United Nations in Vienna, speaking at a side event entitled The War on Drugs, Militarization and States of Emergency, Measures to Address These Critical Human Rights Challenges that was held March 21st at the 67th session of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.